Well, good morning, everybody. It's a call this session's first meeting of the Joint Armed Services Committee to order. It is Thursday, 13 February 2014, and by the clock on the wall, 9 minutes after 11 o'clock. Present with us this morning is co-chair Senator Kelly, Senator Coghill, Senator Wilkowski, Representative Isaacson, Representative Tarr, myself, co-chair Sadler, Senator Faircloth is absent. She's a new grandmother today, so she had other duty. And we have a couple other members who will be here shortly. Looking to see if there's other legislative members in the audience, seeing none. Public members of JASC present with us is Colonel Tim Jones, U.S. Army retired. We have Lieutenant General Tom Case at the table. Welcome, sir. And I believe we have online Brigadier General George Canellis. Can you hear me, George? General Canellis online. Can you hear us there, sir?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Okay, present and accounted for. Fantastic. I would encourage everybody to turn your cell phone off, not just on vibrate, but off, because it can interfere with our PA system. But it's a pleasure to be here. Apparently, this is in a short session, lots of activity. So there are people all around the building and all around the state who are listening by teleconference or by gavel-to-gavel television coverage. So there's lots of folks here, even if they're not here in person, they're here in spirit. Before we do begin the meeting, a brief bit of background on this committee. The Joint Armed Services Committee was established in the 90s in response to one of the first base realignment and closure committees, rounds. Representative Feige has joined us. Outstanding. JASC includes 5 representatives, 5 senators, and 6 public members. Public members represent the interests of military services and agencies, local government, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and Alaskan Natives. To remind all the folks listening, our mission in JASC is to monitor and address potential realignments of our military facilities and missions in the state, to advocate for the National Missile Defense System, to seek out ways to attract new missions to Alaska bases, and to support increased joint military training in our outstanding facilities here in Alaska. Our mission is especially important as the nation faces tremendous budget pressures, both planned reductions and those cuts that may be forced on us by sequestration or other budget shenanigans. It's important for us all to keep in mind Alaska's military services and agencies are essential to our national defense, our joint training and preparedness, our force projection, the safety of our people, and last, the stability of our state economy. I'm very pleased this morning to have with us Alaska's military leaders. Look forward to getting an update on three of Alaska's military leaders. First up, Air Force Lieutenant General Russell Handy, who is commander of the Alaskan Air Command, the U.S. Pacific Command, and other commands. Army Major General Michael Shields, Commanding General of the U.S. Army Alaska, and Deputy Commander of the United States Alaskan Command. And batting cleanup will be Alaska National Guard Major General Thomas Kakis, who is the TAG and the Commissioner of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. As always, time is short, and so I would like to welcome each guest and get our presentation underway. So we're going to hold questions until after each presentation, then we'll go on to the next gentleman presenting. So with that, Lieutenant General Handy, please introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony. We're looking forward to it.
Outstanding. Thank you for that fine introduction. I am Lieutenant General Russ Handy, Commander of Alaskan Command, Alaska NORAD Region, 11th Air Force, and Joint Task Force Alaska. That's a mouthful. And thank you for the opportunity today to come out really and do my favorite thing, and that is to brag about the men and women who have put their hand up in service to their country and they're serving in Alaska. Despite all the thrash of budget woes that we've had the last couple of years, I can tell you the quality of our military force has never been better. And if you are ever feeling down about the future of your country or about our youth, walk out on any one of our flight lines or out on our ranges and spend some time with these men and women, and you'll be refreshed. Now, speaking of that, there's one sitting right next to me here that I wanted to highlight, if you would allow me for just a couple of minutes. Nick Lofthaus is here. He goes by Anchor. Anchor is a very accomplished F-22 pilot, the best of his generation. Very few people get to fly that aircraft. I, for one, am not a very accomplished F-22 pilot, but he's very good at it. But that's not what I wanted to highlight. I wanted to highlight that about 72 hours ago, Nick's wife had twins.
Outstanding.
Two large babies, almost 7 pounds each. And Anchor thought that this was so important that I get here at the right place at the right time, that he escaped from home and left his in-laws with his wife and his two brand-new babies. But I wanted to congratulate him in person, and I'm serious. He knows how important this is, and he's just one example of the fine men and women that you have serving in uniform.
We will allow you to have your cell phone on, and if it rings, take off and don't worry about it.
So this is just a quick overview. I've got a lot of slides, but I'll get through them fairly quickly. I'm happy to take questions and talk about really whatever you'd like to discuss. Many of you were here last year for my predecessor, Lieutenant General Steve Hoge, and he hit many of these things. What I'd like to do is update you about what's going on in the last year and what's going to happen here in the near future. Next. So that's a snapshot. It's hard to look left or right anywhere in the state of Alaska and not run into someone who's either in the military, working closely with the military, or a veteran. We make up about 25% of the population of the state, if you add up all of those numbers, of families and veterans, and so we're proud to have some stability now, I think, and we'll talk through that after going through maybe a little bit of uncertainty here over the next year. Next slide. You've seen this picture before, but I always have to put it up here to remind everyone that we've got a complex organization so that I can kind of outline where we all fit in. And so I talked about the four hats that I wear from a headquarters perspective. The 11th Air Force hat, really administrative command, management of the five Air Force wings, about 11,500 people in Alaska, Hawaii, and Guam primarily. Alaska NORAD region, you're very familiar with what we do there in defense of our nation for aerospace defense. And I just returned from Colorado Springs where we had a conference with the NORAD leadership to relook at the plans. We do that just every couple of years. And then Alaskan Command, Joint Task Force Alaska in the middle. I'll talk in detail about what we do. And at the bottom, everybody but Tom Ostovo is here with you today. And so I'm going to focus on the Air Force units, the Air Force piece, the overarching Alaskan Command, Joint Task Force Alaska, and I'm going to let Mike and Tom talk about their individual components. Next slide. We also work for a few different bosses, and so you'll see that as we navigate through here. But from a combatant command perspective, we really work for three different bosses, the PACOM Commander Admiral Locklear for the rebalance to the Pacific, the NORTHCOM Commander General Jacoby, and General Jacoby also wears another command hat, and that is North American Aerospace Defense Command. So many of you are familiar with these men and what they do, but when we argue for requirements and we go to Capitol Hill to get the tools we need to do the job, these are the men that are stating those requirements for us. Next slide. I think it's helpful to remember that we still have men and women deployed all over. We're not just in Alaska. We've got F-22s in the Mideast right now, and we've had a rotational presence through the entirety of last year, and we'll have them there through the fall, and we'll get relief from that finally. We've got some unique capabilities in our F-22s I'll talk about here in just a minute, but they've been very much pulled to the Middle East, as well as the E-3s. Mike Shields will talk about his folks in Kuwait and in Afghanistan when he gets up, and we were very much a part of the humanitarian relief for Operation Tamayan in the Philippines. Next slide. About 1,350 deployed right now, and it's been somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500, fairly stable. We'll see that number potentially come down a little, but not a lot. We'll go to different places, but we'll remain deployed. Next. As I mentioned, and this was something I think Steve Hoge talked to you about last year, but we underwent a reorganization in our Air Force componency so that all of the wings at those three corners of the strategic triangle now work for the 11th Air Force Commander here in Alaska. And I'll talk a little bit to that because it relates to how we employ together. Next slide. So it was a tough year. And I'm not going to read these numbers to you. You know them much better than I do. It was a very interesting year. We told our men and women to continue to execute as if they had a budget. And then with 7 months remaining, we had to get 12 months of savings. And that was traumatic. We grounded a number of aircraft to make up those budget numbers. When we finally got a bill, it didn't offset sequestration reductions. Mike can talk to the Army impact, but it actually hurt the Air Force a little bit, reduced our operations and maintenance funding by $654 million, and we had to take some fairly drastic measures. Next. We stood down the aggressors, as you know, at Eielson. We severely reduced the flying hours in all of our other squadrons, and we grounded scores of fighter squadrons and bomber squadrons across the U.S. We grounded the United States Air Force Thunderbirds, which, if you understand the impact that squadron has, that was a big deal. That was a big statement, and we stopped flying at the U.S. Air Force Weapons School, which is our the seed corn of our top-end tactical capability. We don't want to do that again. As you know, we also lost Northern Edge and Red Flag 13, too, and I'll talk a little bit to how we're going to get back on the step with that next. We lost faith with our civilians, I think. We furloughed 5,100 of them here in Alaska, and we put a lot of uncertainty into what has historically been pretty secure employment. And quite frankly, a lot of them now don't feel quite as comfortable working for the federal government as they used to. And so I think we've got some repair work to do with regard to the attitude of our civilians. All those other things happen. We got to the 2, 3, or 4-star general level of reviewing individual TDYs, individual trips at the budget level. It was very, very tightly controlled because we really just didn't have a lot of money to get through the year. Next. I'll talk about what that budgetary impact it was in the beginning of this year here in a little while as we look to the future, but we have some budget stability now, which, again, even if it isn't the budget that we requested or that we wanted, a budget stability is a huge benefit that we're now living with. So now moving to our units, talk a little bit about, again, our Air Force units. We underwent an organizational change within 11th Air Force. The 611th Air Support Group, as you've known it before, our organization that runs contracts and maintains things like the Northern Warning System, Wake Island work contracts at Shimia. We renamed them to the PACAF Regional Support Center. The organization looks exactly like it did. We didn't reduce any numbers. We still have a boarded colonel group commander in charge of that. It was really a redesignation based on some Air Force administrative rules about how large an organization you have to be a group. And quite frankly, they're more appropriately named now because they support a number of facilities all over the Pacific, not just here in the 11th Air Force area. Our Air Force shifted corporately in the way we manage environmental restoration accounts. And this is really, again, just for your awareness, we don't see an impact. In fact, I think it'll probably be an advantage because the Air Force Civil Engineering Center has a more corporate expertise on how to manage accounts of this nature, and our Pacific Regional Support Center will still be very involved at the local level. But that transition happened, so you'll see a name change on that. And then I couldn't help but include a picture of one of our PAVHAWK helicopters from the 210th Rescue Squadron and just to highlight their incredible work again in 2013. The number of saves, 121, that's up about 50% from 2012. We had 84 in 2012. You can say that's a good or a bad thing. It's not good for the folks that had to be rescued, but it certainly highlights the critical importance of the 210th and our rescue coordination center. Next.
You know, excuse me. For the record, I'd like to note that Representative Lynn has arrived. Major Lynn has landed.
Excellent. So our aircraft out of the third wing were very busy in 2013 as well. I mentioned Operation Damayan. We're very proud of the C-17's work there, 52 sorties, about 2 million pounds of aid, and the most full C-17s I've ever seen, full of passengers, very interesting pictures that showed up in the media of that, some heroic work during that operation. Supported about 9,000 USARAC jumpers. Mike Shields will tell you that's not nearly enough. We need to do a whole lot more, and we're working on that, but still very active joint training ongoing, and he'll speak to some of that, and we supported a number of POTUS and VPOTUS trips. Our F-22s are now the most capable Raptors in the United States Air Force. We finished a modification called Increment 3.1, and really what that gives is a unique ability to do synthetic aperture radar mapping and drop small diameter bomb, which is our newest ordnance on that aircraft. Part of the reason why they were so much a wanted quantity in the Mideast is they are unique in that capacity. No other unit has finished that modification. Langley Air Force Base is next, and we're slowly working through that. But that brings with it, a unique capability, but an obligation to be able to deploy that capability worldwide when needed. We also finished the backup oxygen system, the automatic backup oxygen system modification, which was the final risk mitigation as a result of our mishap. So we're completely finished with that here at JBEAR. And that modification, again, will work its way through the whole Air Force, but we were the first to get that. Supported three CENTCOM theater security packages, again, very active there, as well as deploying throughout the Pacific for various both training and strategic messaging purposes. And you may have seen recently in the media, we are in the proof of concept phase for a thing that we call Rapid Raptor, and it really fits into the PACOM commander's expeditionary strategy for the Pacific. It's a unique capability that was frankly drawn out on a napkin on a briefing room table by a bunch of our reservists and active duty pilots, and they said, look, we're probably a little too dependent on fixed facilities and big airfields and way too much stuff, and we need to be able to pick up our unit on very, very short notice and rapidly deploy with the ability to turn that aircraft around and employ from that location and then relocate. And so they came up with this, working together with our special operators and our C-17 operators and maintainers, and developed this Rapid Raptor concept. And put very simply, it's the ability to take a small number of F-22s fully loaded, push forward to somewhere, have the potential to employ from that sortie, land at an expeditionary airfield, very short amount of concrete with no support. C-17 lands behind it with everything on board it needs to take care of those aircraft, fuel, weapons that are already assembled on trailers. Very rapidly turn those aircraft and then take off on another mission. We've done local proof of concept. We just integrated it operationally with a full wing exercise at J-Bear last week, highly successful. And you'll see some of that in the Pacific here this upcoming year. And I think you'll see a mix of some fairly overt demonstrations of that capability, and then you may just see them show up to demonstrate that they can do that. And so I believe the PACOM commander will make good use of that new operational capability.
General, just for the benefit of those listening, TSPs, if you can expound upon any acronyms and explain for us.
Yes, well, theater security packages, and essentially what that is, it's really just a term that we use, and it's not just CENTCOM related, but it's a term that all of the combatant commanders use to be able to get a finite amount of assets somewhere for deployed for a period of time to represent presence in a theater. And so you would take 6 or 12 or 18 aircraft, go somewhere for 4 months where they're not normally based, and we do a number of those to the Central Command area of responsibility. We do a number of those to other areas in the Pacific. Next. So the 673rd Air Base Wing continues to set the example, I think, for joint basing across the country. They're doing very well. 85% of their performance metrics have been met. And you can see 58 major command level award winners in 2013, as well as two DOD and seven Air Force awards. Some really good news on the base at J-Bear. Tom Kack has welcomed U.S. Coast Guard Sector Anchorage into his headquarters building. And they've got an incredible facility that they've moved into now right down the hall from Tom's facility. It brings them in from downtown, and it links them in operationally with everything else that's going on. And so I think their joint operations center is about four times the size of the one they had and very, very well equipped. And so we're happy to have worked through the bureaucracy to get that approved and get them moved in, and they're now there and operational. Also, we're really happy to announce that we're going to have an open house this year. We're going to have an air show at J-Bear on the 26th and 27th of July. It's the only place outside of the lower 48 the Thunderbirds are going, so they've committed to that, which instantly makes it very attractive to many other performers, and so we're real excited about the potential for that. It's probably going to be around 250,000 people, and we'll partner heavily with the Alaska Air Show Association and others. I will say we have very strict, all the way from the Secretary of Defense's office, actually very strict funding limits on what we can spend on air shows this year. From the perspective of the optic, we feel it's still a critically important thing to do, and we'll work through that. But we're going to partner as much as we can with folks that will bring both acts and resources to that. Next. So Eielson's been mentioned a couple of times. Eielson was a really popular base for me since I took over in August. A couple of things going on up there. The Air Force has transformed the way it does operational inspections. And Eielson was the first one in the Pacific to do one of those, consolidated unit inspections. The big difference is it puts much more of a burden on the wing commander to structure the inspection over what the wing commander needs to be ready to do. And it sounds like it makes good common sense, but each wing is a little bit different, and no one knows that mission better than the wing commander. So instead of an inspector general developing the scenario independently and coming in and and bringing that inspection to them. The wing commander is very involved in what that inspection looks like with regular quality controls by the inspector general. And they got an excellent on the first one in PACAF, so we're really happy about that with many identified strengths. So, again, General Mark Kelly continues to knock it out of the park up at Eielson. The aggressors are back flying, which we're real excited about. They turned, once they got flying hours, they turned it around very quickly but very safely and were able to participate in a red flag very quickly after that. And they took their team on the road to Australia to push our partnership with that important ally, and they did a mobile training team with aircraft there. Not based in Alaska, but commanded by Mark Kelly as our air support operations group at Lewis McChord. And I could go on for the whole briefing to talk about these guys. It would take me about a half an hour just to list the medals for heroism that they have won. But they've been in Afghanistan continuously supporting our folks on the ground, 5,000 missions, 9,000 troop in contact, almost 2,000 targets serviced. Again, some incredible heroic stories coming out of Lewis McChord. A few things ongoing there, just miscellaneous issues. You all know that the Air Force has formally announced the F-16s aren't moving, which gives us some stability with the installation up there. I'll talk a little bit about F-35, but we're going to start hearing soon who the candidate bases are, and site surveys will begin, and we feel strongly Eielson will compete favorably in that regard. We've had an initial site survey team and ongoing discussions about the potential to base Gray Eagle RPVs, and I think Mike may speak to that. And our dormitory that was the funding was awarded in 12 and then held, has been the funds have been released for that, so we're going to move forward and probably start demolishing that old dorm in April, so we're real excited about that. And I list the power plant because you can't ever talk about Eielson without talking about that power plant. It is a strategic asset. You know, we watch every boiler very, very closely, and we continue to make improvements up there, and the Milcon project on the one boiler is still ongoing, and we hope to get that one burned in here later this spring. Next slide. So I won't go through all of the details on this. I've been reading about your conversations here over the past week, and my sense is you know this process better than I do, so I won't try to teach it to you. But I will say I've been trying to get an idea of the timing of this. I think we're going to hear something later this month on the candidate basis. But I wanted to ensure that everyone was clear that that's really just the first step. There's a lot more to it than that. They'll do some initial site surveys. And then by sometime, I think in the spring, we will get the preferred and reasonable alternatives. And that's when the environmental analysis kicks off. And that process will take a period of time. All happening this coming year, I expect that Eielson will be one of those candidates. I mean, that's just based on looking at the bases that are out there and what they have going for them. Mission capacity, environmental cost will be the big factors that we'll look at. But hope to hear something later this month and move forward with site surveys. Next. Alaska remains the center of gravity for our ballistic missile defense system for North America. I was just up at Greeley last week. It's an amazing facility. As you know, we're getting 14 more interceptors up there and Milcon for another missile support facility. So very much a growth industry up there at Greeley. The missile field 2 construction, I toured that, and that has been completed. And there's many other things going on across the missile defense enterprise to include a new radar that CLEAR is a candidate for. It hasn't been announced where that new discrimination radar will go. I think you also know there's a heat and power plant analysis that was done by our Air Force Space Command headquarters in Colorado Springs. They had made a recommendation to shut that power plant down and hook into the electrical portion of it to downtown power. That's been put on hold. There's a GAO study, a government accounting office study, that Senator Murkowski and Senator Begich asked us to wait until that study was complete and recommendations come out of that. And we hope to hear about that literally any day now because we believe that study's been completed. And then we'll move forward on that. Next. I mentioned our F-22s and our ABOS system. We have returned to fully mission-capable status, and that's a good thing because our Alaska NORAD region professionals remain fairly busy. It's cyclical, some weeks more than others, but we do continue to respond to Russian activity. The Russians are very, very active, in the Arctic, and very active with their long-range aviation. And there are times that they're active enough that it causes us the need to go out there and have a look at them. In the
In the process of that, we're also inspected quite often, as you might imagine, from NORAD, and we were inspected on our Operation Noble Eagle mission and our response to a threat type of mission, and again, hit it out of the park. There are 13 superior performers, 60 identified strengths on that evaluation. Next slide. In a demonstration of our commitment to never leave an airman behind, our recovery operations continued up on Colony Glacier. As you know, that as a result of that crash in 1952, there was a good bit of debris that wasn't identified until just recently. That debris field is evolving as that glacier moves, and so we did recovery operations in 2012. As you know, we did some more in 2013, and we have our first meeting in April of this year to plan for 2014. The experts tell us we've got another few years, and then we'll lose the opportunity because that glacier is moving downstream, if you will, and so we're, again, making progress. Next. We also continue to find unexploded ordnance all over the state. We get a lot of calls from the Aleutians, and our explosive ordnance disposal folks go down and take care of those. We had 9 of those in 2013, again, mostly World War II munitions that are found along shorelines. I also was a part of the Alaska Forum on the Environment here when it was in Anchorage, and talked a lot about the World War II cleanup sites, and happy to report that we're making very good progress. When those meetings, we used to sit down, and General Case will tell you, and it may have been a bit of an adversarial relationship, and it's just not that way anymore. And instead of talking about the cleanup of the old sites, we're talking about the future. We're talking about how to work together on Jay Park to make sure that we don't harm the environment with the things we're doing there, for example. And it's because of General Case and others that have gone before me and the folks that sit together in that room and the way they work together to clean up the site. So making great progress there. Next. And now we'll transition a little bit to what we're going to do from an exercise perspective. And next slide. As you know, 2013 was a challenging year. Of the 5 major exercises that we had scheduled, 3 of them were canceled due to budgetary limitations. We lost our northern edge in 2013. We lost 2 of our red flags. So we only flew 1 of the red flags. It was the only red flag after sequestration we salvaged in the Air Force, either here or in Nevada. But we fought very hard for it because it was historic. The Korean Air Force and the Kokajietai, the Japanese Self-Defense Force, flew for the first time together in an exercise. We were careful how much we messaged that. Sometimes that doesn't go over well, especially in Korea. As you know, there's very long history of friction between those two countries. But I will tell you, at the operator level, it was fantastic. A lot of our units from the Western Pacific couldn't make it because even though we came off the grounding, we did not have enough flying hours in the budget to be able to come to Alaska. And so our F-22s played, some Marine Corps Air played, and some Air Force Reserve and Guard, and the 2 major active duty units were the Koreans and the Japanese. So it was, again, very important that we kept that one going. Of all the exercises, it was the most important, and we're happy to say that we were able to execute that. Vigilant Eagle and Vigilant Shield also, we flew Vigilant Shield. You're probably familiar with it's a responding to a catastrophe and how we work together, state, local, and federal agencies, kind of the on-deck exercise, if you will, for our big exercise that's going to happen starting on the 27th of March, which we'll talk about here in a minute. Vigilant Eagle is an interesting exercise with the Russians. It's one of the only things that we partner with them in the air domain on, and it's responding to the potential for a hijacked aircraft, and it exercises the ability to share the information of that aircraft coming across our boundaries so that we can effectively mitigate it, counter it, intercept it, and that went very well. Next. 2014 will be a big year for Alaska military exercises. Mike Shields will talk to you a lot about what the Army's doing. It's amazing, the things that they've got on the calendar. For us, it really begins with our big major exercise in March. Next. That's a partial list. When we started to plan for this exercise, we put the word out to many agencies that, look, we're doing a really amazing exercise that is centered around a complex catastrophe similar to the 1964 earthquake. We understand there may be a lot of federal, state, and local agencies that would like to participate. Come on out to a big planning conference. And the room was so full, we had people standing in the back. And so then the challenge became looking at training objectives and trying to fuse those training objectives together affect the exercise while not having us step all over each other's. And it's going very well. We think if you count not only all of the folks that will be in operation centers and out there in the field executing this exercise, but the schools that will be doing exercises, we're counting somewhere around a quarter of a million people that will actually be involved. So it's a fairly large-scale event. And again, you can see the goals on the board. It's really to exercise the ability of the communities to respond, assume responsibility for initial life safety needs at the local level, and then the state's ability to roll in, coordinate resources, and quickly support and stabilize the situation while planning forward for sustained response. And then from a DOD perspective, as you know, if in the lower 48 there's a hurricane or some tornadoes that go through Tennessee, the Kentucky Guard is right next to them and they come to the rescue. We don't share that advantage. There aren't any states next to us. So your wingman is the federal government, the DOD forces, our Title 10 forces. So we have to be very good at working together day to day. We have to be very good at falling in a catastrophe, and that's the third objective, the ability to execute that coordinated Title 10, Title 32 response to a catastrophe of this level. Next. Again, that's a partial list. I think we've got most of them on there, but you can see it's a pretty big list of people that are concerned with and involved in this exercise. It's a broad audience. In calendar year 14, we will execute four red flags on the J-PARC. That's huge. When the chief of staff came here about a week after I took over, our chief of staff of the Air Force, General Welsh, came for a visit, so that was a good, welcome to command. It was a wonderful visit, and we talked to him first about our ranges and our exercise program and the risk that we bought by canceling the red flags the year prior. And there's a long list of things that cost us, but one of the most important ones had to do with our international partnerships. We had committed to doing exercises with international partners. Some of them had gone to great lengths and cashed in great green stamps with their governments, and then we pulled out of those exercises at the last minute. So that cost us quite a bit. And so what we told General Welsh is we can plan for just about anything, but we need to know, and we need stability on that. And so he committed to these that week and has funded all of them. So we've got six red flags in the fiscal year happening, three on the Nevada Test and Training Range, and then three at J-PARC. And if you add in the fiscal 15-1, there's four in the calendar year. And they're all going to be great. The second one there in June is interesting because that's when we host the Executive Observer Program, and that's a wonderful group of general and flag officers from all over the Asia-Pacific and Europe that come out. And we got a bunch of new customers for the J-PARC last year. I hosted the EOP this past year, and it was fantastic. And we've got commitments from some countries that we had been working on for a long time. So I think you're going to see the international partnership aspect of the J-PARC very much grow.
Yeah, would that include India as a new partner?
It would. So what the Indian attaché who attended EOP told me is, okay, you've convinced me now. They always wanted to go to Nellis and fly on the Nevada Test and Training Range. And so I think some of it was education on what the J-PARC has to offer. The J-PARC's not like the Nevada Test and Training Range. There are some things we don't have on the J-PARC that we have at Nellis and never will. But there are many things that we have in the J-PARC that Nevada Test and Training Range can't offer, specifically size and scale. Our fifth-generation aircraft need big ranges to do the kinds of tactics that they need to do to integrate together with our fourth-generation fleet. So fifth-gen being F-22s, B-2s, fourth-generation fleet being F-15s, F-16s, B-1 bombers, if you will. We need large range bases with the right kind of threat replication. J-PARC has that. J-PARC also offers the international partners an easier place to get to, quite frankly, and it's more economical than going to Nellis. So we made a strong argument, and India did commit, at least at his level, to push forward for an alternating construct, if you will. So go to Nellis, and then on the next red flag, come to the J-PARC. So that's being negotiated now for the next fiscal year, and I believe we'll see India out here then. Next. 2015 will be a great year. Again, because we've got some budget stability, I feel pretty comfortable saying we should be able to execute this. We've got some commitment to keep the flying hour program and the ranges funded. And so Northern Edge, as you know, is our high-end exercise where we bring in we restrict the international participation because of the level of classification and the level of participation in this exercise because it really is high fidelity. We do a lot of high fidelity electronic attack and other things that only allow us to have certain international players play in this. And it's not just the JPARC. We take it into the Gulf of Alaska, and we'll typically bring in a large naval presence. So Northern Edge 2015, we should have somewhere between 6,000 and 10,000 participants. And then two Red Flag Alaska exercises participants we're working through. As I say, we're hoping India will be one of them. Next. JPARC continues to be a centerpiece of our joint and our international partner training here in Alaska. In 2013, the Air Force published a record of decision which completed the environmental analysis that we've been doing to expand the range in a couple of key areas. And I won't walk through all of those, but there are a few really Army-specific expansions and a few Air Force-specific expansions. So that record of decision isn't the beginning of the work. It really kind of starts the work now. An awful lot of coordination to happen before any of that occurs. We're at the stage now where we're socializing that record of decision across the general aviation community with the FAA and with Fish and Wildlife, et cetera, and we've gotten inputs back and are working through those. The Fish and Wildlife Service has recommended a bird study, which is an unfunded requirement for us right now, to operate at the low altitude regime in the Fox military operating area. And so we're working through those details. Next. Now I'd like to take just a few minutes and talk about the Arctic. You can't look left and right longer than about 30 seconds in Washington without finding someone who's very excited about the Arctic right now. And that's a good thing. And prior to just a couple of months ago, everyone was excited about it, but they weren't really maybe sure what they were excited about. Next slide. And now the good news is we've got a strategy. We've got a presidential strategy, which has been out for some time. We got a DOD strategy. Secretary of Defense put out a strategy in November of last year. And we got an implementation plan from the president just about a week ago for his strategy. Now, these are very broad, strategic-level pieces of guidance, so they don't get down into detailed requirements. That's now our job. So talking to General Jacoby last week about this, what he and I have agreed is we've got some very good but very broad strategic guidance. We've got a lot of great tactical activity going on, which I'll talk to here in just a second at the ALCOM level. And what we need now is a focused combatant commander mission analysis on the Arctic, and that's their number one planning priority right now. They kicked off a series of meetings just this past week to really neck down hard on, okay, with the strategy in mind, what is that really going to mean from a DOD perspective? I'll tell you, the Secretary of Defense's strategy, it was very broad, but it made a couple of statements that got my attention. One was, in the short term, the Secretary is comfortable with the level of infrastructure that we've got in the state for the Arctic. But in the longer term, we need more fidelity on what those requirements will be. As you've seen other countries very aggressively jumping into the Arctic from the perspective of the ability to break ice and move through there, there's an economic interest. Russia is especially active, and they use their military for many things in support of economic activity that the United States would typically not do, and so you'll see a great Russian military activity up there. Again, we don't feel like we've got a big military threat coming out of the Arctic right now, but we do feel that as the activity increases, the Department of Defense needs to look hard at what our presence needs to be to support that activity. Next. So at the Joint Task Force level, we have divided up our what we call our campaign plan, which is kind of my little guidebook, is what I'm supposed to be doing, into lines of operation. And there's four of them, and they're listed there. But the Arctic is one of them. So one of the four major lines of operation I have defined is Arctic. And that, as we'll talk about here in just a second, can go in a number of different directions, both defense and defense support to civil authorities-wise. But you start to identify things like needing to study energy and produce better ways of production and distribution of energy. Mobility in the Arctic is something that isn't like mobility in the lower 48. Communications are very challenged up there. I just listed one very tactical example. We're really interested in a high-frequency antenna in the Barrow area. It would enhance our communications ability on the northern slope in a huge way. Again, another one of those unfunded requirements. But that's just one example of the kinds of things that come out of these campaign plans. Next. many of you are familiar with and have sat on our Energy Executive Steering Group, and it was formed, as it says up there, to uncover energy strategies. The DOD, we consume a large amount of energy, and at all of our bases, we've got really a homemade wooden shoe for how we produce and distribute energy. They're all just a little bit different. Some are very efficient, like our plant, for example, down at J-Bear, and others are very challenging, like our huge plant at Eielson. So we've stepped back and formed a partnership with a number of organizations to try to look at cost comparison, environmental implications, and where we could better partner to work together on energy. However, it's a bunch of folks who didn't even stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night like me talking about energy. And so what we really want to do is get the pros from Dover involved in this, and it's listed on the bottom. The Department of Energy is actually tasked within the President's Arctic Implementation Plan to look at energy. They specifically speak to renewable energy, but what we'd like them to do is help us with a holistic study of energy within the state. And so we're working through. We've got some very low-level head nods from the Department of Energy that they would be interested in that, but they're interested in a demand signal from the state and from the DOD. And so I've been discussing this with Representative Sadler as well as the governor, and so I think we're going to move forward and start talking more aggressively to DOE about helping us in that regard. Next. Another one of our working groups that's very productive is the Arctic Working Group, and this is really, again, just an effort to bring synergy and focus to the many disparate activities that are going on in the Arctic. It's an enduring organization made up of my staff, ALCOM Joint Task Force Alaska, and many external military and component representatives. They've really got an overall responsibility for conducting the deliberate planning for our Arctic activities. We typically spin off smaller groups. Right now we've got a group focused on a concept of operations for Arctic search and rescue, which we feel we have a valid requirement to be able to respond. I showed the photo of the 210th Rescue Squadron helicopter. You know, we do support in that regard. We're not the first people to respond in a search and rescue environment over the landmass of Alaska, but we're often the only one with the unique capability to do that, as you know. And so as we see more activity in the Arctic, whether that be on the North Slope or in the waters, Tom Ostebo and I are talking a lot about, do we have the capacity to respond to that to a small or a large scale? So we're looking at things like sustainment packages that we can put up in the Arctic to be able to help survivors while we execute a recovery operation, communications, again, which I mentioned, and ground mobility. So that's an example of the kinds of things that have come out of this working group, and we spin off into that. And again, what we do from that is we study it, we come up with either a concept of operations or a way to integrate into one of our plans, and then we push to our boss at NORTHCOM to advocate on our behalf for that requirement. Next slide. Laundry list of other activities there. I won't read them to you, but other initiatives that are going on in our command. There's a few that we're working in-house. I'd like to identify one and highlight it, and that's our partnership with UAF. That's become particularly powerful through this past year, through 2013. Steve Hogue, my predecessor, and President Gamble signed a memorandum of understanding that essentially commits to an enduring DOD, specifically ALCOM, and University of Alaska partnership on Arctic issues. I visited them last November up at UAF, and I'm very, very impressed, not only with their Arctic capabilities and knowledge, but their enthusiasm for this partnership. And we've got an action plan with UAF that lists many areas of partnering. One of them is Arctic domain and security orientation. It's a very small-scale course that they have put together for us. It was focused initially on teaching new members of my staff and new members of the NORTHCOM staff in Colorado about the Arctic, because we put people on the staff and we suddenly expect them to be experts. But we're getting a lot more interest in that, and we're looking at expanding that project potentially. Again, that's another unfunded requirement that we threw some money together, and we're looking for ways of sustaining that in the future. So we're frankly in the process now of gathering interest on how much interest there would be beyond that smaller scale effort so that we can move forward on it. Next slide. In order to develop better Arctic understanding, we also invite a number of experts out, and we host a monthly speaker series on the Arctic. These seminars bring in representatives from other Arctic stakeholders, state, local government, Alaska Natives. You can see a couple of our, or one of our recent speakers, Senator Murkowski. Senator Begich is coming out on the 18th to speak to us as well, but some fascinating folks who have really given us a new perspective. The Department of Defense, I think, has a habit of examining something sometimes in isolation, and we develop these very expensive, elegant solutions, and when in some cases there's a lot of really good activity going on at the state, local, and even corporate level that we can learn from. And so I visited the North Slope about 2 weeks ago, and again, just walking through their capacity to respond to an oil spill or to respond to some sort of an emergency, they've been doing that a long time. They've got a lot of great capability, and I can learn a lot from them, and I think we can teach each other. And so that's the reason for this speaker series, and we're learning quite a bit from it. Next. So we started and we'll finish with the budget. I want to conclude my prepared comments by talking a little bit about the DOD budget for the future. I remain cautiously optimistic for the next 2 years. I think that I'm hearing good words, and I think we'll have some stability in our budget, which, again, is half the battle, and that's what we've consistently told our leaders. You know, we need to be budgeted. We have requirements. If we can't meet those requirements, then we'll figure out how to mitigate that. We'll restructure, or we'll come up with a new way of doing business. But if we just don't even know what we're going to be budgeted for, it cuts us off at the knees. And so predictability is very important to us. And so I think we've got some degree of certainty. I say cautiously optimistic because there's a – now that we got an NDAA, there was, I think, maybe a tendency for some folks to go, okay, good. DOD's is fine. They can move on without having to execute any of these cuts in force structure or cuts in manpower that were projected. Couldn't be farther from the truth. As you all know, we are – that was part of that budget proposal. We got funded a little bit less than the initial – president's budget proposal. We're still going to cut a number of soldiers and airmen and sailors, probably on the order of 25 to 30,000 airmen. The time frame we're going to take to do that is to be determined. The air staff is kind of working through that, but I will tell you, we've already got a number of force management programs that are on the table and in execution. I'm writing retention recommendation folders on enlisted airmen and officers as we speak for boards that will meet, that will decide that some folks who potentially thought they could serve until 25 years will now have to retire at 20 or even earlier. Some folks that have been in the Air Force for 7 years because their career fields are so overmanned by the new numbers that we're going to ask them to leave when they had thought for perhaps that they would serve. Now, we're offering a number of voluntary separation incentives, and we hope that we get the bulk of those on those voluntary programs. Quite frankly, it's cheaper, it's more economical for the Air Force to offer a voluntary incentive, some money, bring the numbers down to where they need to be and reduce that manpower bill. The Army's going through a similar structure, which I know Mike will talk about. And there will be some modernization impact to every one of our programs. All of our service chiefs are comparing how much of a hit we can take in the readiness account to be able to still move forward on our modernization. We've got a very old Air Force. Some of these airplanes are very, very old. We need to continue to modernize. We need to bring F-35 on. It's important from a modernization perspective, and it's important for an international partnership perspective. We have sort of made a contract with many international partners on that program. We need a new tanker. The KC-135 is an incredible aircraft, but it's aging, and the KC-46 needs to come online, and we need to move forward on development of a new bomber. Our bombers are also getting very old. So those programs, again, are still out there. The chief will continue to juggle how much of a hit he can take in readiness to be able to produce those weapon systems. Next. That said, we are, relatively speaking, doing pretty well in Alaska with regard to force structure. We're fairly stable. Mike Shields will talk about some drawdown we're going to see in the Army in a couple of areas. Air Force is fairly stable. Unit-wise, again, we will see some career fields just reduce in numbers, so the population in a unit may come down a little bit. But overall, the numbers are fairly stable. We're going to increase the number of people working up on the hill at J-Bear in the 381st Intel Squadron. That will become a group here. In the next year, we're moving the group headquarters out of Misawa, and so that's announced, and that'll give us a few more airmen to that important intelligence mission that they do. And we've still got some military construction that are out there. I've kind of listed just a few of those. Greeley's got the MILCON approved for their Missile Field 1 building. and clear for the radar upgrade, and then a couple of projects at Wainwright, in addition to the dorm that I mentioned, which was fiscal 12 money at Eielson. Next. So finally, I just want to say, I'll finish by saying what I mentioned at the Alaska Forum on the Environment, that the steering group that I chaired, I said, look, just honestly, I've served in a lot of states in this union, and I've seen good and not so good relationships with state, local, and military officials and units, and it doesn't get any better than Alaska. When I go to the table with any one of you gentlemen or anyone that you work with or any of the mayors and sit down to talk about J-Park expansion, whether or not F-35s could potentially come to Alaska someday, what sort of activity F-22s need to do, how many soldiers we need to be dropping out on the range or firing artillery. In some states, the first word out of their mouths may be, that's going to cause a lot of issues with the community, or there's a lot of noise involved in that. In Alaska, I get the, okay, how do we make that happen? How do we get to yes? Now, you're certainly not going to ignore your constituents, and you're certainly going to take care of your communities, but it always starts with that. How do we get better at working together? And so I just thank you for that. That's not easy. I know that's hard. It would be a lot easier to say no. But I know that you understand the critical importance of working together with the Department of Defense, and I respect that and appreciate it. Thank you.
Fantastic. John Haney, thank you for a wonderful rapid fire, lots of information, good briefing. A lot of questions I had have already been answered. So I'll look around the committee table to see if committee members have questions for General Haney. Co-Chair Senator Kelly.
I just have a couple of them. You had talked about Red Flag this summer with the Korean and the Japanese contingents, and you begin to go down a path on that. And I, strangely enough, I had heard some stories about the pilots involved between those two countries. There's a young man actually from Fairbanks, born and raised in Fairbanks, who was involved there, and he's a kid I've known since he was little. And he talked about that to his dad, who then talked to me, about this thing that happened between the Korean pilots and the Japanese pilot that no one expected. Could you riff on that a little bit, or is that something you were aware of?
Well, I may not be aware of any specific instance that you're referring to, but generally speaking, what we saw was an evolution of, everyone brings their own historic baggage with them, and you've got to believe that these men and women who came in from Korea and from Japan are sort of thinking about that. But over the period of the exercise, you just gradually saw them starting to interact more. You know, they were kind of standing on opposite sides of the room initially in the debrief, and then, you know, they started to get together a little closer, and then we had to, you know, kick them out of the building for crew rest to come in the next day. By the end of the exercise, they were working together like they were part of the same force. And they actually were. Again, they were the two primary active duty units, in addition to our F-22s resident, they were the two primary units that deployed in. And so they very much made up the bulk of the force employment packages. And on any given window of airspace time, they were typically the last people on the range. And they're, you know, what we call delousing, which is one aircraft is, you know, running away from the threat and the other one is supporting them. And so you had Japanese pilots delousing Korean pilots, and it's something you never would have imagined, I think, even as recently as just a couple of years ago. But they're very, very much an interest to work together. The other thing, which I think was somewhat different than you may see in Asian cultures in the past, is they were very interested in the debrief. They were very interested in getting into the room and watching their tapes and being critical of themselves and each other's performance and figuring out how they can do better tomorrow. And my first operational assignment was in Japan, and you didn't see that then. And very, very different attitude, and I think they were learning that from our folks, and then they were learning from each other. So the short story is, yeah, they just came very, very close together by the end of the exercise.
And another question, Senator Kelly.
Can you talk a little bit about, you had mentioned the Arctic as well, and I think in the last 4 years that I've been aware of, and I know it's been discussed far previous to my tenure here, but in the last 4 years, I've heard a lot of discussions about the need for a hangar up north at Barrow. Is that still a critical need for our defense of the Arctic, or the new expanding role that we may have in the Arctic?
We don't know yet. I mean, we've talked a lot about that, and that's really the reason why I've asked the NORTHCOM commander and his staff to really dig in at that combatant command level, because that's, as you know, where requirements are generated. And then to survive first contact with Capitol Hill, it's got to be written down somewhere from a combatant commander as a requirement. And so I think the first thing that we should, you know, any planning process starts with facts and then assumptions, and we've got to define what those are and what are we assuming about the level of activity in the Arctic in, you know, in 15 or 20 years. Although I think we can all agree on the reduction of the sea ice, you know, as a general statement, you can't pick up two papers written by two different scientists and you know, see agreement on exactly what that means or how much activity that will be. And so I don't know if a hangar is the right answer, or do we just need an expeditionary capability to drop in search and rescue packages, which we've got a small one now, and we feel we need more capability like that. But that's what this requirements definition process will come up with.
So much of what your job is doesn't really have anything to do with us, other than we say yay and we cheerlead. But that's one of the rare things that we can actually build up in this state is our we can actually ante up some capital projects, and they have been identified for us by a group that General Katka sits with, which is our MFAS team. They've made that recommendation and others, and I think we need to look more seriously at our capital budget for planning future for strategic needs that the federal government may have.
Well, especially, especially things like improving mobility, communications, so like the HF antenna that I mentioned, things like that that could be multi-user. I mean, those are, I think, very ripe for partnerships with between the state.
The chairman and I have talked about this a little bit, and that is that we don't. It is frustrating, as I think I said before, that there's so little we can do as a state. When the Department of Defense decides to move one direction or other, we found them to be very responsive to us and very polite, and you couldn't ask for better partners. But in fact, most of those decisions are made quite a long ways away. But my point is, and I don't want you to answer this now because I don't want you to be put on the spot and have to kind of make something up to sound more polite, and that we really want to know what we can do. It is something that the co-chair and I, when we first were appointed to this, we said we are not interested in having meetings and getting our pictures taken with guys with brass on their shoulder so that we can put it in a brochure. We want to make sure that we're able to do something that aids your mission. So please think on that. Give us a list, and we just want to start going down that list.
Well, I appreciate that, and I also appreciate the comment about decisions that are made sometimes behind the doors in little rooms, and you might be shocked as to how late in the game we learn about it as well. And a lot of that I know is politically driven, because the DOD's got to be careful about what they say, because there's always going to be conflicting opinions on that. And that said, what we need to do is help work through the bureaucracy of that. You know, I think we can sit around and admire the problem for a long time and lose opportunity. Section 331, the NDAA, is a great example. And Mayor Hopkins and I have had plenty of conversations about this. And it's, in some cases, you get fuzzy answers back from elements of my federal government when you ask them about what you know can and can't be done under that. And so we are working hard to get through that and figure out just exactly what is practical. But I appreciate that offer, and certainly will continue to move forward. Mm-hmm.
Can we have questions from Representative Isaacson and Feige? And
thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have three questions also, but following in line with the questions that Senator Kelly just asked, Co-Chair Kelly, one of the things, as you're aware, we do have the Arctic Policy Commission, Legislative Arctic Policy Commission, and I just invite you to invite our co-chairs, Representative Herron, Senator McGuire, to be speakers. They would also be very informative in that process.
Excellent.
I'm sure.
Great.
One of the things that I heard overseas when we were doing energy issues with our Arctic neighbors was the buildup of Russia, actually, and you mentioned it in your comments, on islands across from, for example, Diomede, the Alaskan side, and estimates up to 250,000 people over there, and a lot of questions as to why. And, of course, we know shipping is a big concern, and you mentioned the fact that we are lagging in certain infrastructure, icebreakers, for example,
right.
Other things. But as is it unclassified to tell us to the extent that we're monitoring that to make sure it's not a escalation of military activity and not simply economic?
Well, I mean, I can tell you we are and we'll continue to monitor it, but we don't have a good idea of the intent. You know, you can look at forces, you can look at population, but getting into the intent of it, I think, is a little bit harder. I think, as I mentioned earlier, it seems to me that the bulk of what the Russians have been doing is in support of the either economic or potential for economic opportunities that will emerge in the Arctic, and they are much more apt to use their military forces to facilitate that, where we typically wouldn't do that. Industry, you know, operates on their own, and we support if there's a problem. But so I suspect that that's probably part of it. Now, obviously, if we start to see, you know, large amounts of aviation or that sort of thing move in, that would catch our attention. So we will continue to watch it, but we don't have really any better intent reading on it than you've seen openly.
Thank you. If I may follow up, and we know missiles might be something that, of course, you'd probably be watching for too, and makes some of us.
Oh, that would get us. That would certainly get my attention. I'm sure you'd hear about that.
Yeah. I was glad to hear the intel buildup, but I won't go into that right now. Just two brief questions. One is you mentioned that under other initiatives on slide 34, that the UAF is providing you some valuable research partnerships. And in your estimation, do you view expenditures of the state at any particular university center as a regional expenditure, or in this case, you mentioned UAF, so I'll just ask, do you see that as a regional expense or a statewide and even national benefit?
I think it's both. Well, it's certainly at least statewide, but I think it's both statewide and national benefit. And we funded we paid the development cost for that course, but certainly they brought the expertise to the table. But there are things that they do just organic to the university that benefit us, you know, from the perspective of education. So there haven't been any large expenditures that have come out of that, but they're very impressive, very much the experts on the Arctic as we see it, and so we lean on them heavily for information that we'll use nationally. So I think it's both at least state, but also with national benefit.
Well, thank you. And one real brief, very brief. You mentioned the Thunderbirds coming up to Jade Bear. Any possibility of getting them up for a couple hours at Eielson?
Boy, I don't know. I could certainly ask. That's typically somewhat challenging because it introduces some risk with regard to, you know, whenever you move airplanes around, you risk breaking them. And so there's a maintenance package that goes along with that. But
we'd love to have you
there. Yeah, I'll certainly ask.
Thank you.
We have a limited amount of time, so I'm going to ask our members to keep their questions brief. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General, thank you for the briefing. Along the lines of some more additional opportunities for civil-military cooperation, I represent the district that includes Fort Greely. You've got a fine aviation facility there, Allen Army Airfield, and the people of the Delta region, or there's about 5,000 total population. If they want to go anywhere outside, they have to drive to Fairbanks, get on a plane to Anchorage, to wherever. I have started a conversation with their local installation commander, Lieutenant Colonel Spies, and what I'm looking to see if we can do, and I'd like to enlist your support in this, is to look into the opportunity to establish scheduled air service out of Allen Army Airfield. I realize there's obviously security concerns with moving in and off base, but it would be a great opportunity for the local military community to work, certainly with the civilian population. It's a win for the civilian population. It's a win for the image of the military to allow that to move forward. I think not only would you realize cost savings for just, you know, citizens traveling, but your own personnel going in and out of Greeley. There's a lot of back and forth between Greeley and the lower 48, back and forth, the missile command and whatnot. You may be able to see some cost savings in that regard. So I realize that because it's a missile command sort of facility, may not necessarily be directly in the chain of command that you're part of, but certainly would appreciate if you could help the installation commander there work that issue and perhaps provide support to him.
You bet. In fact, General Shields and I were just talking about that this morning, and we're going to take that on to look into it. I haven't driven that. I know exactly where you're coming from in that. You hit it on the head with regard to the command relationship. I'm often a coordinator without a lot of command authority, and the best example in Alaska is probably Greeley. It's an MCOM base, but Space and Missile Defense Command have the mission that MDA project managers execute, and the Guard does the security for the missile fields and executes that mission. So it's a pretty complicated relationship. Nowhere in there is ALCOM or 11th Air Force. That said, it's certainly a fair question, I think. And so those chains that I just spoke about will be the ones that General Shields and I will you know have to speak to and engage. There may be issues that I'm not familiar with, so I certainly couldn't commit to it, or I couldn't even answer what kind of a question I'm going to get back from them or what kind of an answer I'll get back from them. They may need convincing, or they may be all for it. So, but we'll certainly take that on.
Well, thank you very much, General. And, for me, I have a trip to Washington, D.C. for the first week of March. Always easier to know exactly where to go in the Puzzle Palace to find things,
right,
and to make things happen. And I know from my experience as a company commander a long time ago, it's a lot easier to push from the top down than from the bottom up. So if you could assist me in that, that would be great.
You bet. So we'll be in touch before your visit. I appreciate it. I only visit Washington when I have to, but I understand exactly what you mean.
Thank you, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, General, for the briefing. And just back to the issue of the potential F-35 basing up at Eielson. This summer, what we learned a lot about was the competitive nature of, you know, these relocations with working on the F-16 issue. And just wondering, when we were up there for a visit, we did tour the power plant, talked about some of the significant issues. Do you see an opportunity for the legislature to be a part of some of the capital upgrades there, and how would that impact the site selection process as a, you know, making us more favorable?
I certainly would love to say yes, and I'd love to find a way to do that. In fact, Mike Meeks, who chairs one of our subgroups, and I, we talk quite a bit about that in the concept of, you know, is the juice worth the squeeze, for lack of a better term. Is there a way we can partner and find an effective and efficient way of wheeling power back and forth, you know, and will that be of an advantage to us? And we need to study that. And that, frankly, is part of why I wanted to get DOE involved, because they've got the kind of expertise to be able to help us with that. We've come to a point where we either need to hire a contractor who is an expert or get DOE's assistance to study it. I hate to jump into something and get the legislature to commit to something and then find out later it really wasn't worth the effort for them or for us. And so I think I'd certainly love to be able to answer that question affirmatively with some data.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yep. I'm going to engage the chairman's privilege to ask him last question. If I could you comment generally or specifically about China's military capabilities and how that may affect Alaska's planning for Pacific Rim security?
Wow.
In five minutes or less.
That's a long answer. In my prior job to this, I was in Hawaii as a PACAF chief of staff, working with Admiral Locklear's team to build the current strategy that we're executing, that some of you will hear General Carlisle talk about tomorrow night at the ASYMCA event. But it's a fascinating subject. You know, we are incredibly tied to China in so many ways, not, you know, economically and otherwise. You know, we don't want to fight the Chinese, and the Chinese don't want to fight us. No one wants a conflict in the Pacific. What we have, I think, are differing views on how we define sovereignty in some cases, differing views on how we deal with each other, and so that's why that partnership needs to continue to be pushed. And I think the PACOM team is doing a really good job of bringing China in. I think they're, you know, trying to bring them in as much as they can to be a partner. China's made it very clear that we're going to continue to develop, and if we choose to just ignore that and keep the wall up, I think that increases the chance of conflict. If we break that wall down and talk to them about that and figure out how we can continue to evolve and develop together, we'll be much better off. So that said, anything that happens in that area will impact your military men and women in Alaska. I mean, our forces are assigned day-to-day to the PACOM commander, both the 11th Air Force forces and the USARAC forces. Mike will talk to you a lot about the sorts of capabilities he builds with his Army partners, and we are continuously training with our Asian partners as well. So the biggest impact I think we see that's maybe different from what we've seen in years past for our folks is much more of an emphasis on that partnership piece. We've all come to realize that we can't do anything independently, that we need to gather the capabilities and be able to work together. The good news is, if there are some good news to the conflicts that are going on in places like the Senkakus, it's motivated our partners to be much more enthusiastic about those partnerships, about coming to things like Red Flag, about doing integrated air and missile defense exercises with Japanese general officers at the table as a air component commander, which we've done twice now in the past 10 months, unprecedented for the Japanese to do that. And so our capabilities together are improving, and that's the type of thing you're going to see your forces in Alaska doing, I think, a much more aggressive partnership with our allies and partners.
Thank you very much. I think there's an endless amount of questions, and I'm learning an awful lot from our dialogue, and I wish we could spend more time, but we have two other generals behind you with a lot of information.
I don't want to make these guys mad. They're both bigger than me.
With thanks for your presentation, Elian. Thank you very much. Look forward
thank
to seeing
you.
You next year. I will take this opportunity. I should have neglected this. We do have with us a new staffer who is the staff to the military, excuse me, to the Veterans Caucus. Eric Holland is a former in the corner wave, Eric, who is a former Army Ranger and Green Beret, and he works for Colonel Senate President Charlie Huggins, and he is the staff to the Veterans Caucus. So I want to make sure everyone casts eyes on him. An appropriate time to bring up the Army, I guess. General Shields. Now for the green portion of our briefing. Appreciate having USARAC represented. Thanks for making time for your schedule to be here. So if you can introduce yourself and your command situation for the record and give us your presentation, I'll sure appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for having me today. And I understand it's been a while since the CG of USARAC has had the opportunity to speak here. My name is Major General Mike Shields. I'm the commander of U.S. Army Alaska. That does not include Greeley. We talked about that a bit earlier. It does not include Army Corps of Engineers. But that, it does include approximately 12,000 outstanding men and women. We're split-based. We've got approximately half of our force at J-Bear on the Fort Richardson side with an airborne brigade, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a bit, and engineers, as well as our NCO Academy, and we've got our Striker Brigade and our Aviation Task Force up north with our cold weather and mountaineering facility out at Black Rapids. It's an exciting time to be in USARAC. We're transitioning from 13-plus years focus on counterinsurgency with back-to-back deployments of our maneuver forces. I will tell you that the war is not over for us. We have soldiers in harm's way right now, and we're getting ready to send more. And, in fact, my engineer brigade commander is over there on his pre-deployment site survey right now. So we're transitioning. We're transitioning from a focus on preparing for counterinsurgency to decisive operations in support of the Pacific Commander. So when I talk about our training exercises a bit later, that's kind of where we're focusing. I love this photo. You probably haven't had a chance to take a look at it, but it elicits interesting reactions with my engagements across the Pacific. Unless you know what you're looking at, it doesn't really jump out. Let me talk you through this photo. Clearly, this soldier just jumped. And if you look at the boots that he's got on, it's an extreme cold weather, right? He's wearing his snowshoes. Those are MSR shoes, pretty good technology, and he jumped his skis. We haven't done that for a long time in Alaska, okay? And we're getting back to our roots. So we're focusing on our mission essential tasks in support of the Pacific Commander, what we need to do to be able to support JTF Alaska, but we're also getting back to our core competency, which is to be able to operate at high altitude, extreme cold weather, and mountainous terrain. And this picture tells you a lot. It also tells you that he's carrying too much equipment, right? There's a lot of things. He's got a laser. He's got a tac light. He's got the latest close combat optic on that rifle, and he's ready to execute the mission. But it doesn't jump out at you when you see the picture, and he's determined, all right? So there's no telling, you know, what he's done before this photo was taken. That's a heck of a load he's carrying. If he's got to climb, that load's got to get lighter. Those skis, the same skis that were here when I was a brigade commander in 2004. The skis have got to improve. That's one thing I appreciate as I travel and meet with our partners across the Pacific is some have really moved out in this area and have taking advantage of some of the new technology from a mountaineering perspective and from a Arctic mobility perspective. I'll talk a little bit about that in the future. What we've been charged to do is to train our forces to be more flexible. And what I mean by more flexible is rapid response, tailorable, right? So we have our typical battalion, brigade formations, but that's not how they're going to deploy. We'll task organize from across USARAC to form packages. It could be in support of disaster assistance, humanitarian relief, or it could be something along the lines of decisive operations. But the reality is they won't go as a pure organization. And we're getting back to being able to operate in austere environments. That means get back to field craft. No longer are we going to necessarily be able to operate from mature forward operating bases or combat outposts. We'll be required to go to locations where limited water could be incredible, temperature differences, immature logistics, and so on. So those are the types of things that we are pushing and focusing on right now. I'll talk about this operation a little bit later, but if you remember Talisman Sabre, the operation in Australia, where the Airborne Task Force flew approximately 17 hours continuous flight, in-flight rigged, and jump into Australia. An incredible demonstration of strategic reach for the Pacific Commander. That was a great joint operation with the United States Air Force and others. That was pretty significant, but what you're about to see in the next 72 hours is going to be more significant. And so I'll talk about that in a bit. And, of course, we've got to maintain our proficiency in cold weather. And General Brooks, who's my boss, from USARPAC, has charged us to be the preeminent cold weather mountaineering capability in the Pacific and the Army. And NWTC is really taking on a larger role, our Northern Warfare Training Center at Black Rapids, because what we're starting to see are our foreign partners coming here. We've got the TIEs that are here right now that are training with 425 Airborne, and there's going to be a large-scale, massive airborne operation that's coming up here over the next this next weekend. Into Thailand, and I'll talk about Cobra Gold a bit later. We had the Nepalese, we had five NCOs from the Nepalese Army that were here for our NCO Academy, and as General Handy mentioned, unfortunately, we had to shut the school down and send them home. So we're rebuilding some of that capital, but they're coming back this month, which is great. We have a team that's heading over to northern Japan, north of Sapporo on the island of Hokkaido, to train with their mountaineering and cold weather unit, and they are sending a team to Black Rapids at the end of the month. And so that's just a sample, and I'll talk a little bit more about this later. Next slide. The mission has evolved. Like I mentioned, we were shifting from the counterinsurgency focus to the decisive operations focus. And where we really make our money is focus on leader development, and that's really my main effort, is developing our junior leaders and our bench for the future. What we're talking about are competent, committed leaders with character. We do that through unit training, but we also do that through what we call our Warrior Leader Course, which is at JBIR. And we pull our junior non-commissioned officers from Fort Wainwright, Black Rapids, down. And we actually will have National Guard participate as well. And we've started a great program where I'm starting to send soldiers to the Air Force NCO Academy and vice versa on JBIR. So we're really expanding our purview, if you will, and we don't have all the best answers, but we're going to go find them. And so that's something we're investing in heavily. Our team, next slide, and this briefing wouldn't be complete without one of these slides. So if you look at the far left, you know, I'm tucked up under USARPAC, and I work for General Brooks, who's the USARPAC commander, and we provide forces, train and ready forces in support of PACOM. But I wear a couple of hats just like General Handy. I'm his Deputy Commanding General for ALCOM, also Deputy Commanding General for JTF Alaska, and I'm the Senior Mission Commander for Fort Wainwright. And now our forces aren't necessarily apportioned and committed under NORTHCOM, but for defense support to civil authorities in times of disaster, that would happen. So we focus on that piece as well, and we're a part of the exercises that go on in Alaska, and we'll be a big part of the exercise that occurs in April as well. But that's kind of our task organization piece. The one thing you won't see up there, and this is relatively new with the pivot to the Pacific, is that First Corps out of Joint Base Lewis-McChord now has responsibility for all Army forces in the Pacific from a training and readiness perspective. So I'm still, my boss is General Brooks, but I will take guidance for training and readiness from the First Corps commander. And we'll be getting a visit from General Lanza here real soon. We're routinely back and forth to JBLM as well, and have been for actually quite some time. For us, that's a good news story. It's another great advocate for our readiness requirements. It's a great advocate for our Arctic requirements. That's a great thing for us. We've had training and readiness relationships with other organizations. For example, our aviation task force up at Fort Wainwright, one of the battalions, the CAV squadron, receives training and readiness guidance coming out of Korea from 2nd Division, and the LIFT battalion takes it from 16th CAB at JBLM. So it's not new to us. What is relatively new is that are the two infantry battalions getting training and readiness guidance from First Corps, so through me to those brigades. So it's kind of exciting. It's exciting times for us, and we look forward to that. We also provide rapid response forces for both combatant commands. So at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, you've got a task force, an airborne task force, that has already mobilized, has uploaded, and is standing by to respond to the PACOM commander's needs. It's an airborne contingency response force on a short string. And works obviously quite closely with the Air Force. And then we have a task force that's up at Fort Wainwright that is the quick reaction force, rapid reaction force for NORTHCOM for support for situations in Alaska. I'm not going to talk about it later, but we have an emergency deployment readiness exercise program where we exercise readiness of those units and their ability to rapidly assemble, alert, marshal, and deploy. But we exercise those in the state. Could be something local, could be something at Donnelly, or could be something quite a bit larger, different various scales. Next slide. This slide's kind of interesting. It shows how we're organized across J-Bear and Fort Wainwright. Like I mentioned earlier, I've got the Airborne Brigade and the Engineer Brigade on the Fort Richardson side, and we've got our NCO Academy. And then as you look north at Fort Wainwright, of course, we've got MCOM that commands the garrison at Fort Wainwright. We've got the Striker Brigade. We've got our Aviation Task Force, which is commanded by a colonel. We have an Assault Lift Battalion and a CAV squadron that's equipped with OH-58 Kiowa Warriors. And interestingly, both of those units are getting ready right now to deploy overseas. One's going to be going to Korea, our first operational deployment to Korea for a 9-month deployment. That's our CAV squadron. And the assault battalion is getting ready to go to Afghanistan. So I'll talk a little bit about Afghanistan down the road, but that's just one example of how we support the combatant commands. In this particular case, Pacific Command and CENTCOM. But we do have some UCOM activities that we support as well. There's two key activities that are a priority for us. They're very small, but what they deliver is an incredible capability, and that's our NCO Academy. We're looking at force modernizing that, bringing it into, they call it Classroom 2020, but virtually bringing it up where we can collaborate virtually with other NCO academies in the Northern Warfare Training Center. So we're looking at how do we expand our capacity and capability at Black Rapids to be able to handle not only the increase of our units, guard units, Coast Guard units, special operations. We just recently had the FBI through. As well as our foreign partners. So we're going to have to work our organization a bit to be able to support that. That's a pretty tough group down there. You know, they don't live down there. They're away from their families almost every week of the year. Their families are at Fort Wainwright. But they're down there supporting missions across DOD and the interagency, and it's a pretty incredible mission. We're looking at expanding their skill set. You might say, what do you mean by that? Well, we have one of only the few high-altitude marksmanship ranges in the Army down at Black Rapids. I've been up on that thing at minus 30, and it's pretty exciting. We're going to expand our capacity there. The ability to bring in SOF, interagency, and others or foreign partners, that's another area that we're looking to expand. And our cadre, looking to push them out to the premier climbing, mountaineering, and cold weather schools. Canada's got great schools. There's great schools in California with the Marine Corps at Bridgeport, as well as up in Jericho, Vermont. So we kind of move around and look at best in business, if you will, to incorporate those things that we can bring back to Alaska and tie in with our NWTC. Next slide. I think you've all seen this before. This slide's great for appreciating the strategic significance of Fort Wainwright and J-Bear and our ability to project combat power into the Pacific. My partners, as tasked by USAPAC, include India, Mongolia, which is also a partner with the Alaska National Guard, Nepal, which I just got back from, Japan. We're routinely in and out of Korea in support of PACOM missions, and also we'll partner with Canada. And in fact, we've got Italy visiting this summer as well, who's interested in the Arctic, and I'll probably be expanding partnership in meetings with Russia as well in the fall. So with a lot of folks coming and going within U.S. Army Alaska with engagements. We send folks to some of their schools. We had a captain who graduated number one at India's High Altitude Warfare School, which includes pretty technical climbing in Kashmir. We've got folks that attend the Nepalese High Altitude Warfare School. I was just there actually a week ago, an incredible climbing facility, cold weather facility. And they're actually very interested in what we're doing at NWTC, and we're going to start to see them cycle in as well. I'm very passionate about the cold weather and the mountaineering piece. Without state-of-the-art equipment, it's very difficult to operate. I'll give you a good example. Sometimes we test our equipment to be effective at minus 20. Then comes the human factors engineering piece. Okay, so when it gets to be minus 30, minus 40, which we often see at Wainwright, Donnelly, Greeley, you know, can the operator actually make that piece of equipment work with about 10 seconds he has to take or her to get those gloves off to push that button, to take that, switch that magazine, and so on. So we're taking a hard look across all of our, we call it Dotland PF, but training equipment and so on, to make sure we have the best equipment, and if we don't have it, that we're getting it prioritized and teed up both through Pacific Command and through NORTHCOM. That includes our Arctic mobility capability. You've seen our sustainment vehicles, our track sustainment vehicles. The Guard uses a similar vehicle. We're looking to modernize that fleet as well. Right now, we're kind of at the point where we're pulling parts out of, off of old ones to keep them running. They are, as old as they are an incredible vehicle, and they can go anywhere, both. And we use them in the summer as well. So that's something we're going to be pushing. This kind of depicts our deployments, if you can see the slide. Off on the far left, you'll see our support to CENTCOM, which is Afghanistan. So not only do we have soldiers there now, we have soldiers that are preparing to go, both the Engineer Brigade Headquarters and our Aviation Task Force that are getting ready to head over this spring. Bangladesh is also a partner country with us. Relative to a few of the others, we don't do quite as much there. But that will increase over time. And I mentioned, we'll not only do we partner with these countries' high-altitude warfare schools or their cold-weather training facilities or centers, typically named like ours, but airborne brigades as well. So 425 at JBAIR will partner with the Japanese 1st Airborne Brigade in their CRF. They'll partner with the Indian Airborne Brigade. Right now they're partnered with Thai Airborne. Yes, sir.
CRF.
Contingent Response Forces.
Okay, thanks.
And what you'll see with the strikers, they'll typically partner with perhaps a heavier force. So the Army of Northern Japan is a heavier force. So we'll see 125 heading over in March to develop the relationship with the Northern Army and their 7th Division and their Cold Weather School. So it is an exciting time to be in USARAC with the shift to the Pacific and our responsibilities under USARPAC and PACOM. This just kind of gives you a snapshot of what that looks like for us right now. Slide. Number of exercises that we'll be participating in. I mentioned Cobra Gold. It's ongoing from 11 to 21 February. We just had a number of Thai soldiers jump with us, and, of course, we jumped with them. You know, pretty big deal, so they exchanged foreign jump wings. We had Thai jump masters putting American paratroopers out of those aircraft. Udavas with India. We continue to deploy to our combat training centers. There's three of them. There's two that we'll deploy to, National Training Center and the Joint Readiness Training Center at Fort Polk, Louisiana. So this spring will be a very large deployment of Alaskan soldiers to JRTC at Fort Polk, where the 4th of the 25th we'll do a strategic air move. We'll jump into the exercise, and they'll be supported by over 1,500 soldiers from Fort Wainwright in different roles, opposing forces, civilians on the battlefield, and trainers. So it's going to be really an Alaskan team effort for that one training exercise for the Airborne Brigade. The following year, 125 will get the same experience, but at the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, California. We are going to do an extreme cold weather Arctic jump called Spartan Pegasus and Dead Horse, and I had the privilege, and as did Tom with the company General Handy up there, and it'll be a one of those Arctic experiences. But it's going to be a combination of things. And not only is it a personnel drop with our Arctic equipment, skis and so, but we're also heavy dropping our SUSVs and sustainment vehicles, so we have Arctic mobility when we get there. So that's going to be a great exercise for us. Small, but we'll build from there. Then, of course, you've heard about Alaska Shield and our participation with that as well. Slide. Cobra Gold. This has been a great training event with the Thai Army. I think what I'd like to mention say is that if you can imagine what it's like to have a 19-hour flight, so we'll go a couple hours better than Australia, okay, 19 hours, several in-flight refuels, an in-flight rig, and a jump into a mission in Thailand, which will execute in about 24 hours, and then it will turn around and do the same thing back into Alaska. An incredible demonstration of the strategic reach of the Pacific, of the PACOM commander, from Alaska into Thailand. And an incredible capability demonstration by Air Force to get this airborne task force there and to refuel in flight. So you'll see more about this, I think, in the media. You see a kind of a picture of them going through the airborne training in the lower left, and that's Colonel McFarland, who will lead the task force. And when they get on the ground, from a mission command perspective, they will fall up under the command of the 25th Infantry Division. And so that's what we talk about, tailorable, flexible, scalable. This is a great example of it. Next slide. There's a number of Arctic initiatives that we're pursuing with reduced resources budget. You know, we're really going to push to get one company per maneuver battalion, Arctic mobility, trained to become experts. We're going to train our scout platoons in those same battalions to be Arctic mobility experts. It's more than just skis. It's more than just snowshoes. That's also aircraft, things like fast rope, insertion, extraction, and so on, into high-altitude areas such as up on ridges where you can't set helicopters down and so on. So we're going to be pushing that hard. We're really going to be working our partnership hard with the countries that I mentioned, and that will grow. I think the interagency piece will grow. And I think we'll see probably greater soft participation here over the next few years. We held and participated or hosted the recent USERPAC Cold Weather Symposium. The results of that, we had over 70 different organizations present to look at our requirements to be able to operate, not survive, operate in this type of environment and to be successful. The results of that also feed General Handy's Arctic Symposium and so on. So it was a great meeting. From that, we actually picked up some resources. We're going to get some support from some other DOD or DOD organizations to help us with some state-of-the-art equipment, such as skis, cold weather gloves that work in this environment for us. Just a small example. There's more. And then, of course, we're also involved with the UAS dialogue and discussion. You know, we have organic tactical unmanned aerial vehicles, such as Raven and our Shadow. Gray Eagle decision's not been made yet, but you know that could be coming up into to the northern Alaskan area, and so that's an exciting time. And then collaboration with our partners to improve our mountaineering capability. Next slide. This is our Ready and Resilient campaign. This is part of a larger, broader Army campaign. It is not episodic. It is continuous and it's ongoing. I guess the one thing I'd like to say with this is we're committed to this, and we really appreciate the support we get from the community, such as an Anchorage Star, who come onto the post and help us with the sexual harassment, sexual assault prevention. We're working our partnership with the university systems for working with, for example, theater departments for bystander intervention scenarios, acting out in sit, if you will. So there's a number of innovative things that we're working both with the local community and with the university system to get after some of these challenges. We had a week-long focus on it in USERAC this past fall. I personally took all senior leaders, put them on. We went to every organization at JBIR that provides services and support to both our soldiers and our families. And the brigades do a very good job of working this as well. But it's something we continuously have to improve, and it's a focus for our command. And that's really the point I wanted to make here. Next slide. Fort Wainwright. Some great news at Fort Wainwright. The ROD has been signed for Taku Gardens. So I think by around September, we will probably have those 110 units occupied. So that is great news for the Fairbanks community. I will tell you that we still have a shortage of barrack space at Fort Wainwright. We still have soldiers living in temporary barracks that were put there when I was deployed to Iraq with the Stryker Brigade. And at minus 30, minus 40, that can get sporty. So, you know, the barracks is the number one MILCON project for USERPAC, so it is getting visibility. MCOM is tracking that. If you were to ask me what's my number one priority for Fort Wainwright, it would be get the barracks square away for our soldiers. We've got great housing, great support there. And we're also, there's the number three MILCON project up at Fort Wainwright are the company and battalion headquarters and some of the motor pools. So we've got to continue to push that because that takes care of who's there now. We're going to grow at Fort Wainwright. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a future slide. Go ahead. I'm really proud of this, and I asked the team to put together a slide. I push the team to become involved in the communities both at Fort Wainwright and in Anchorage. And we do a pretty good job, but we can do better. We will do better. But we had over approximately 4,000 hours volunteered to the school system. Every one of my battalion-sized units is partnered with a school district in and around our bases. And it's something that I personally get involved with up at Fort Wainwright and down here, whether it's coaching, whether it's helping out at recess. And it's kind of interesting some of the feedback I get from local leadership, impact on bullying, things of that, things that are probably tangential benefits, I think. But the sports are big. We also, work with some of the coaches from the university system. We do team building exercises with the UAF hockey team. You probably saw in the Anchorage paper one of the days we did team building with the UAA hockey team at Fort Richardson, where they got exposed to some of the ways that we prepare our soldiers physically for combat. They had a great time, incredibly physically fit group. And enjoyed it. And we put them in situation for some of our combat type roles, which help build teamwork and those types of things. So it's not exclusively limited to the hockey teams, but we do have an active program going with both hockey teams. But the school sponsorship program, I'm particularly proud of. Next slide. Army structure changes. This will probably interest you. We're going to reduce our force structure here at JBEAR. We're going to reduce by approximately 800, and we're going to grow by approximately 360 up at Fort Wainwright, and that includes family members. But I would tell you that's relatively low when you look at the big Army. What you'll see is a tip in the scale of forces. You'll see the future, and it'll take a while to implement this, where we'll have 6,000-plus up at Fort Wainwright. That'll include the team that works out at Black Rapids as well. And we'll have over, approximately 4,000 at JBEAR. So the balance of forces will tip up towards Fort Wainwright. And we'll just have to be really vigilant with looking at the barracks requirements, unit motor pool requirements, family housing requirements, and then support services at Fort Wainwright to be able to handle that increase in personnel and their families coming into Fort Wainwright. And that's something that I pay particular attention to with Colonel Zemp, who's the garrison commander up there. And we'll also face a staff reduction at USERAC, not necessarily across the units, but at USERAC headquarters. So that will reduce about 25%. So that will impact our range operations, and so we're looking for ways to mitigate that. This slide, this is kind of, I'm proud. And I'm honored every day to be serving with these men and women. But these are just a couple of examples of some of the awards and honors that have been awarded to USERAC soldiers. To include, we had the soldier who won Soldier of the Year for the Army, the whole Army, Soldier of the Year. Our NCO won the USERPAC NCO of the Year. We just had an E4 who came in first place at Fort Benning at the E4 and below marksman for the marksmanship competition. So we have great soldiers. We have great leaders. This is just kind of an outward manifestation of it that you can see. But there's a lot of other great things that are going on every day within USERAC. Next slide. I think I'd like to steal General Handy's quote where I remain cautiously optimistic with regards to budget. I think we'll probably get a little more back this year. Typically how we fund things like high-tech gloves, Arctic mittens, or with end-of-year monies, you know, my charge to the staff is, look, we've got to prioritize and get this up through combatant command, like General Handy mentioned, to get it on their prioritized list to get it to D.C., but it's got to go through the combatant command. We chip away at it each year for things like extreme cold weather mittens, fuel handler gloves, things like that that work for us here, but it's usually end-of-year monies, and we're actually very good at it. But that's not the way to sustain for the long term. So we're working that real hard. And General Handy's been great with things like the Joint Sustainment Vehicle of the Future. The SUSV isn't going to last that much longer for both us and the Guard. And we're looking at what's next. And we're looking at what other countries are using, Japan, Canada, others, members of the Arctic 8, who also have Arctic mobility equities as well. Slide. I guess my closing thought and comment would be we are ready and we are relevant, and as you can see, we are deployed across the Pacific and the CENTCOM AOR. We're incredibly proud of our relationship with the state, and I'll echo General Handy's comments. I've never seen the support in any of the locations that I've been state like we get at Fairbanks and Anchorage. It is incredible. So thank you for your support, and ready for your questions.
Thank you very much, General Shields. Questions for the General? Got Senator Coghill and Representative Tarr.
First of all, thank you, General, and thanks to the troops. So let people in your command know how grateful we are. One of the things that I watch as a community is from the deployment to reentry to the post and acceptance by the community, sometimes they're doing a change of command at that point or a PCS. How have we as a community been able to interact with some of those, because it happens so fast that I know it's a big change to the soldiers, to the airmen, to your command structure. Is there things that we as a community have missed that we need to be more aware of?
You know, that's a great question, and I experienced it when I came back. Within 2 weeks, we did a mass brigade battalion change of command, and 50% of the unit was essentially moving out. And then we reflagged on top of that to 1st to 25th. I think how we do our reception has improved significantly. And because of the decrease in the volume of deployments, you don't see it so wholesale. We have companies that are over there right now versus brigades that are deployed over there. I think that our community outreach is very good in that regard. I think how we receive the soldiers back, how we reintegrate them into the community. And the Army's done, I think, a pretty good job of recognizing that we need to create some space. So it's gotten better. The tough part, of course, is when you have the changes of command, because you have a loss of continuity. And that's something that I and my chain of command have got to do, particularly the brigade commanders, because a lot of the deployments now are really at the smaller unit level, with the exception of the two battalions that will go to Korea and Afghanistan, and the Engineer Brigade headquarters that will go to Afghanistan. We're going to have to really watch this deployment period between now and next fall, because that's the same period we're executing the structural changes at JBEAR with a reduction. So with the Engineer Brigade headquarters will go away, but while it's managing all of that, it's actually in Afghanistan. And so the equipment disposition of that piece and how we treat the soldiers and how we treat their families and how we recognize them for the service and take care of them as they move forward to other assignments is going to be really important. And then our unit sponsorship program is really important. We're pushing that real hard so that we can identify the team that's coming in, because that's as important as the team that's going out. And we want to make sure that we have a sponsorship program that indoctrinates them into the lifestyle and whatever community they're in, whether it's at Fort Wainwright or Anchorage, and open them up to the Great Alaska experience that they're going to be exposed to, but also teach them about the community, the uniqueness of Alaska, the Alaska Native people, and so on. So we're really working hard on that sponsorship piece. We got a ways to go, because sometimes they're coming to us right out of advanced individual training, and we don't know they're coming. And I'd like to think that we have the officer thing licked, but we don't, because I just discovered a aviation lieutenant that showed up that we weren't tracking at all. And so it's minus 35 up in Fairbanks. He just showed up. He doesn't have any cold weather. I mean, those are the kind of things we've got to avoid and get better at. So it is taking care of the soldiers that redeploy, taking care of their families, and ensuring we get the assignments that they need on the back end. Some will continue to serve and stay. Those that are going to PCS or ETS, we take care of them. And then it's also taking care of the leaders and soldiers that are coming in to backfill, to make sure that we embrace them and don't somehow lose control of that in the cross. And all that's going to be going on during a really demanding period this spring and summer, next fall, as units are either transforming to something else, which is going to happen with the structural change, or actually will go away altogether and then make sure we don't lose control. So we've got everybody on our staff focused on that, as are the brigade commanders.
Just one thought, and just any way that
Senator,
we as a community can.
Senator Cargill, I'm sorry, my co-chair needs to leave.
I've got to take off, and I just wanted to thank you, gentlemen, for coming. I always appreciate these briefings. You don't just mail it in. We get a very thorough briefing on what you're doing. General Katkis, sorry that I can't stay. Appreciate it.
And other members either have or need to peel off. That's tight schedule, so I just want to apologize to you presenters for that. And Senator Conga, for your indulgence, thank you.
With the social service world, we're considering our budgets here, and so we're always alert to that pretty dynamic community. So any heads up we can get from your leadership for our community, I think we're willing to work. It's just, it does happen pretty fast for us, and we're a little slower on the uptake.
Well, I appreciate that. I'll take that back, too, and make sure that we're reaching out as well. Thank you.
And very briefly, General Shields, I want to let you know that we did attend the paratroop experience at the 425 at J-Bear this interim, and really appreciate that. I hope you can duplicate that for other folks. It helps explain an awful lot of what's going on out there in the sky outside of our windows. And I will also say I was sorry to hear about the reductions in force structure at J-Bear, and I appreciate there's some pluses in up the interior, but we do take a statewide perspective and understand and appreciate the fact you're making decisions on based on national security and not our own necessarily local interests. So thank you for that. Other questions briefly, Representative Tarr for the General.
Thank you. Thank you, General, for the briefing. And just on that point, with housing issues in Anchorage, you know, it's described as superheated market, very limited housing. And do you know, for the 800 soldiers that, you know, J-Bear is going to lose, were most of those living on base or were they living in the community, do you think?
That's a good question. I mean, I'll have to get back to you. I don't know the percentage of that group that was actually on base or in barracks, vice housing. Okay. But I'll go back and get those data points and push them back to the committee.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Pardon me. Seeing no other questions, General Shields, thank you very much for being here. Glad to have you here for the JAS presentation and hope you can continue to make time in your schedule in the future for this.
Thank you.
Good deal. And with apologies to General Katkis, please come forward and I've heard briefings from General Katkis. I know he can talk as fast as I can listen. And with apologies to the General for the members who have to peel off. Again, it's a busy schedule. And we have folks who have to peel off for other commitments at 1 o'clock. So,
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm Major General Thomas Katkis. I'm the Adjutant General for the Alaska National Guard. And I can probably keep us right on schedule because I'm very fortunate to be able to follow General Shields, who kind of put it best. We're ready and we're relevant. The Alaska National Guard fits that category because almost everything that we do has been described already. All of our folks fit into some mission that is an active, relevant mission, and we support and or participate directly under the ALCOM commander and or the USAREC commander. And you start looking at some of the taskings that we have, a little over 4,000 men and women in the Alaska National Guard between the air and the Army. Go ahead, sir.
I just want to make sure you have more than 5 minutes. We have the room as long as we need to. I know some of you peel off, but if we did start about 10, 15 minutes late, so please take the time you need to present your information.
Thank you very much for that opportunity. What I mostly wanted to present in the ready, relevant category was recently the big discussion is between the operational reserve, the National Guard having all the experience that they've got from being in conflict for the past 12 to 13 years, and a strategic reserve. So the operational force. We have been privileged to have the Chief National Guard Bureau, the four-star who sees and has visibility of all 54 states and territories in the District of Columbia. His recent visit up here to Alaska was to commemorate a National Heritage print, which was directly as a result of a pretty sensational rescue that involved the Coast Guard and our Air National Guardsman out of Dillingham. So that print was here, and while he was here too, he got to see how the Coast Guard dedicated a facility. But what he came away with was a true concept of operational force. His remarks were he has never seen another National Guard unit as well integrated into a mission, a ready, reliable, strategic mission, operational mission, tactical mission, than when he saw here in Alaska with his visit. So those kind of accolades and those kind of statements sum it all up, that with our missile defenders, with our air defense squadrons, with our mission at clear, with our missile defense areas that we've got, I don't think you can get any more strategic. Then you lay on top of that the sensational rescues that our Rescue Coordination Center facilitates, and then our PJs and rescue men out of our Air National Guard execute. It doesn't get much better than that for being an Alaska National Guardsman. Real quickly, our status on the Army side. This is the one key point I want to hit here. Out of our authorized 1907, we're at 1899, so we're at 99.6% strength in the Army National Guard. We've got some new equipment coming on board, structural changes, but overall, nothing large or nothing as far as significant changes for the Army National Guard. Missions that we have currently right now, this is important to folks. Afghanistan, we're down to 3 people in Afghanistan, but more importantly, at Guantanamo Bay, we have 82 personnel. They have a brigade level staff that supports, and they also have a small platoon that actually does security of the inmates, that the detainees that may be down there. So I just recently got back a week ago from a visit down there. Morale is exceptional. The weather is nice, and our Alaska National Guardsmen are enjoying that deployment. It's a very positive experience, and I think it's reflective upon our numbers and our recruitment and our retention numbers there. So that's the good takeaway here. And also our A Company aviators, they just got back from Kuwait. That, again, was a very good mission for them. They got to do a lot of things that they had not been able to do in the past. Next slide, please. Air National Guard, again, those are our go-to guys whenever anything happens in Alaska, it would seem, but also the nation. They are worldwide deployable. Our current strength there, not quite as good as the Army National Guard. We're at 89%. Relatively, we are looking for a few good men and women that fill those ranks, and that is happening because as the active forces draw down, we always pick up additional people that do want to remain in uniform services and support this nation, and we provide ample opportunity with what you see there as some of the missions that we've got. Force structure changes, you're aware we lost the 4 C-130s. We actually kept one as an additional aircraft with the assignment, so it's only truly a loss of 3 aircraft. And that has mostly an impact on General Shields' area, where they supported a lot of, or would have been, supported a lot of the jumps. So the relevant mission there, it was built, cuts are what they are. And like I said, it was not as bad of a cut as some other states took as far as their National Guard force structure adjustments. Next slide. Deployments for the Air National Guard. We are going to continue to deploy a little bit heavier than our active deployments out of the Army National Guard, mostly due to our expertise in combat search and rescue. Those folks are continually engaged, continually deployed, and make up the preponderance of the major awards that you see reflected there. Some of the significant areas there, the Rescue Coordination Center in the 20 years is 5,000 missions and 2,000 saves, and that's a big accolade for that group that has, they do the tough missions and they do them right and they do them all the time. So with that, any questions?
Thank you, General Kakis. Questions from the committee members?
Just comment on what you did with some of the disaster relief in Alaska this year. On behalf of many, many people along several of the places in Alaska, we're grateful.
Thank you for those comments, sir. It was rewarding for the members that participated, especially in the Galena area. That was a nice day with the perception of everything peace and calm, but that dike was definitely a threat to the remaining community members, and everybody realized that. It was a good event.
One of the other questions, I know that deployments are a little different than you have in a regular Army, but still integration is one of the issues, and these people have service areas at home. How is your view of that? Are we as a community doing well to receive them, our services? Do we have blank spots, things that you see that we could do better?
Anytime that we have an exceptional individual that's overlooked, missed, and if there's even one, we can always do better. And we can always do better because every now and again we do miss them. But overall, the resources that DOD has provided not only to the active forces but all the National Guard members in our reserve is pretty impressive. And we take care of families. We address the issues that involve our partners when it comes to employers. Those are some of the things that DOD doesn't necessarily see until they start dealing with National Guardsmen because that affects communities. But the community support in Alaska, bar none, is exceptional. And our men and women in uniform in the Alaska National Guard definitely appreciate all of those efforts.
Thank you. General Kakis, could you speak briefly on your recruitment and retention efforts statewide Alaska? What quality recruits are you getting? Any challenges or opportunities that you're meeting?
The challenges are constantly there only because as a nation, we still have a very, very, very small percentage overall that qualify for military service. There aren't any exceptions when it comes to the requirements for being able to have physical health, being able to have the right education, having the right background without criminal discriminators that would disqualify you. So when you start looking overall, we're in a very competitive market for a very small population because there's other businesses out there looking for the exact same men and women that we are seeking. We do face challenges in Alaska primarily because of the rural organization. We don't have access. Travel is always difficult. Education is always difficult. Trying to provide those folks that live remotely the same opportunity and privilege to join our military services as anyone in this nation. So with that, our efforts are continuing, even the hard to get to. This isn't recruit from the easy, low-hanging fruit. We try to strive everywhere, but weather, distances, mechanical, you name the obstacle when you start talking the distances that we experience here in Alaska, and it is a challenge. It's the expense, and in budget tightening, we have to look for ways to do things smarter and better. So enlisting a lot of the support from our local law enforcement that are present on the ground to help us recruit, mentor, and provide leads. We also engage heavily with our Yellow Ribbon programs to try to get out and get the veterans that are currently living out there in those remote communities. Those are some of our strongest advocates because somebody just showing up from Anchorage or Fairbanks for the evening and trying to talk a village community member into joining the military, that's not going to work. You got to start early, constant, and continually engaged to mentor them, keep them out of trouble, get them on the right path so that they fully qualify for the military. So it is no, yeah, I've got an answer for that. It is an engagement strategy, and it starts from when they're very young and through many commands to carry that strategy through.
And General Kax, if you could say a brief word about our the state's strategic partnership in the Pacific region. We heard General Handy speak about the region-wide. What about the state of Alaska to our partners? What's the status of that? What are you doing?
Our partners as far as Mongolia. Mongolia, I'm going there in 2 weeks, and we continue to send troops over there for engagement exercises as far as supporting training. It's motivational for our folks. It's also a great exchange of ideas. When we have Arctic Care or one of our efforts out here, we've managed even as a state to try to bring over participants from Mongolia so that they get over here to see what we do in country. Because we're very similar as far as weather, we're very similar as far as how it affects equipment, our tactics, all of the other efforts. So we still are very strongly engaged. We're still the model partner. We're going on 20 years of the partnership. National Guard Bureau has strong support for the state partnership program, and constantly Alaska's relationship with Mongolia is identified as a model program. So very proud of that.
Thank you. Okay. Other questions for General Kakis? Seeing none, thank you very much. I'll say in summation, I'm proud to team with Senator Kelly to co-chair of the Joint Armed Services Committee. I think it's a tremendous platform to remind Alaskans around the state and in this building about the incredible range of missions, facilities, capabilities, and personnel we have operating in Alaska. Meetings like this, the briefings we have, both the formal conversations here and off the record, off in the halls, help us tremendously in our mission to advocate for Alaska's military bases. I look forward to continuing to work with all the members of the committee and the leaders in Alaska in session and in the interim to keep doing what we can do to meet challenges and to take advantage of opportunities. Seeing no further questions, I want to thank General Handy, General Shields, General Kakis, and your staffs for all being here. And look forward to seeing many of you tomorrow night, couple nights, in Anchorage for the salute to the military. With no other business to come before us, JASC is adjourned at 8 after 1 o'clock.